Okay, we're back for episode, is it 93? 93. 93, okay. I don't know if there's any catalytic powers in those numbers, but we'll see. 93, episode 93. Well, Joe, I want to know one thing.
Sure.
Are you Nair, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Sure.
You're supposed to take the fifth.
Communist Party. I tell you the truth. I was actually swept up by, the workers' paradise when I was in college. I thought that this made a lot of sense. And I started, it wasn't until I basically was in South America trying to make ends meet as a reporter, and I actually saw and met people who were actual Marxists, that I started to realize it was insane. The infatuation lasted for a couple years, but when I actually met Marxists, I quickly saw that they were, it wasn't just a bad, economic idea. There was something really wrong with them mentally. They were crazy and violent, and they had no real
nihilism, materialism, yeah, these things. Yeah.
I also saw in my generation, you missed this, fortunately, but like in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a lot of, kind of college kids that got into Marxism, or derivations of it.
Yeah.
And basically, it was just part of the youth culture, sex, drugs, rock and roll, and Marxism.
Yeah, that might factor into our discussion tonight.
I'm not a member currently, kind of think it's the worker, my position on the workers' paradise, you have to be careful of them. And I just think that Marxism is a pseudo-economic system. It was not taken seriously by the people who developed it. It was just, the idea was just to create an illusion so that people would give up political control so they could be genocided. So that's how I take Marxism. And we're going to talk about Joe MacArthur, Tail Gunner Joe today. He was opposed to communism, or at least as he understood it, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. Of course, the key to, I think, having sympathy for communism is not living under it and observing it from afar and reading about it in textbooks and turgid journals of left-wing academics and these things, perhaps. Of course, that you had to talk to Marxist talk in the 60s to get the chicks, so...
That was key. That was really what attracted me. I mean, it was without that, you had no chance.
So. Okay, well, McCarthyism. Okay, McCarthyism is a name given to this period in time in American history that saw Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy produce a series of investigations and hearings during the 1950s in an effort to expose supposed or alleged communist infiltration of various government agencies and bureaus. The term has since become sort of a byname for defamation of character or reputation by means of widely publicized indiscriminate allegations, especially on the basis of unsubstantiated charges. I think the era of McCarthyism began, or at least most historians trace it back to February 9th, 1950, when Joseph McCarthy gave a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, firing his first salvo. He claimed to be aware of 205 card-carrying members of the Communist Party who worked for the U.S. Department of State. A few days later, he repeated the charges in a speech in Salt Lake City. McCarthy soon became to attract headlines, and the Senate then asked him to investigate, or at least to go investigate further into his charges. Of course, who was McCarthy? Joseph McCarthy grew up a Democrat, ran as a Republican for the U.S. Senate in 1946. He defeated three-term incumbent progressive Republican standard bearer Robert La Follette Jr. during the primaries. He then went on to win the general election handily as part of the post-war sweep that brought the Republicans back into power in Congress after 14 years of being in the minority. McCarthy was elected to the Senate in 1946, rose to prominence in 1950 when he claimed in a speech that 205 communists had infiltrated the State Department. McCarthy's subsequent search of communists in the Central Intelligence Agency, the State Department, and elsewhere made him an incredibly controversial figure. In 1952, he obtained the chairmanship of the Committee on the Government Operations of the Senate and its Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. McCarthyism reached its peak and began its fall during the McCarthy hearings. These were roughly 4 weeks of televised investigative hearings led by McCarthy in 1954. After first calling the hearings to investigate possible espionage at the Army Signals Corps of Engineer Laboratories in Monmouth, New Jersey, the hearings reached their climax when McCarthy suggested the Army's lawyer, Joseph Welch, had employed a man who at one time had belonged to the Communist Front Group. Welch rebuked the senator famously. He said, "Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?" Of course, McCarthy from this point started to take a hit in the polls, and there was a sort of a publicity campaign against him. This was spearheaded by Edwin R. Murrow, the famous journalist. He had a devoted at one his television show See It Now to a devastating piece on Joseph McCarthy. Joseph McCarthy was then censored by the U.S. Senate. And he died in 1957. Now, you have to look at the politics of this thing. Of course, this was mostly during the Eisenhower administration, 1953. Eisenhower sort of chose to ignore McCarthy because he didn't want create a division within the Republican Party. The context of McCarthyism itself didn't begin with McCarthy. I mean, this is the Cold War, and the Cold War was really declared by Truman and the Democrats in the late 40s. President Truman himself had ordered background checks for every civilian in service to the U.S. government. This, of course, in the wake of the Alger Hiss case, when Alger Hiss was exposed. He was an official of the State Department, high-powered official in the Roosevelt and Truman administration, and he was convicted of perjury. Because this is the famous Alger Hiss Whitaker Chambers thing case or showdown where he denied knowing Whitaker Chambers. Whitaker Chambers was a former communist. He'd been a member of the Communist Party, I think, from the late 20s until 1938 when he became disillusioned with the Stalinist purges. And he exposed Hiss as a communist. And Hiss denied knowing Chambers. And Chambers then was able to manifest evidence or proof that he did indeed know him, but documents that he got from Hiss's State Department typewriter. So Hiss was never convicted of espionage. That had stayed, the statute of limitations had passed, but he was convicted for perjury and exposed as indeed a Soviet spy. But then this contributed to this atmosphere of fear of communist expansion or world domination. Of course, the communists themselves exploded their own atom bomb reportedly in 1949. This was largely because of espionage that basically the entire Manhattan Project had been infiltrated by communist spies. And by the late 40s, various Soviet spies within the U.S. government, State Department, and the Manhattan Project itself, which was a military project, had turned over secrets and technology to the Soviets so they could achieve that by 1949. Also, you had the so-called fall of China, which had been, at least from the evidence, just orchestrated by the American elite. Truman also passed the Alien, or had passed the Alien Registration Act. Sorry, this was in 1940, and this made it illegal for any United States advocate to abet or to teach desirability of the overthrow of the U.S. government. Of course, that would target the Communist Party of the United States. And McCarthy himself began receiving evidence of communist infiltration and activity in the United States by the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. And it was William Selvin, one of Hoover's agents, later admitted that we were the ones who made McCarthy's hearings possible. We fed McCarthy all the material he was using. That's interesting because Hoover himself was very skeptical of the CIA and OSS, either out of patriotic reasons or for sort of bureaucratic turf battle, and he kind of egged McCarthy on. But it wasn't the whole. A lot of people tend to conflate McCarthy and McCarthyism with this whole era, but again, it predates Joseph McCarthy's investigation of these things. In fact, some people accuse McCarthy of being an opportunist. Now, if he didn't, is indeed an opportunist, that may be the case to a certain degree. He was indeed a politician. It had to exist. I mean, he had to sense some sort of political benefit for doing this. Therefore, the atmosphere existed prior to McCarthy, and indeed it did, because you had the HUAC hearings, the House Un-American Activities Committee, which is, I think, started in 1937, originally called the Dyes Committee. But after the Second World War, it began investigating leftist or communist activity. And it was HUAC who went after Hollywood and made dozens of Hollywood figures testify, and those that didn't, the so-called Hollywood 10, were placed in contempt of Congress and given prison sentences and these things. It also ushered in the era of blacklisting. And this wasn't McCarthy; it was HUAC, and in the House that was doing this, House Un-American Activities List. We have this going. Also, it was you have to look at McCarthy. McCarthy himself had high level support. The Kennedys supported McCarthy. In fact, he employed Robert F. Kennedy on his staff. He also brought in Roy Cohn, an interesting figure to say the least, in 1952. He had been impressed. He had actually, Roy Cohn, I think it had been suggested to McCarthy to hire Roy Cohn, by J. Edgar Hoover, who was impressed with Cohn's involvement in the prosecution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, the couple that facilitated, they were part of the Green Glass Network, and they were pivotal in passing on information or technology that the Soviet Union used to develop the bomb. Now, again, it's some have said McCarthy made these unsubstantiated wild charges, saw him as a political opportunist, but as I said earlier, that assumed that he acted on the fact he was acting to expose communist infiltration. It's just that it was politically beneficial to do that, and it did indeed exist. American communist infiltration was real. And that's been subsequently been proven by declassified documents and decrypts, particularly the Venona intercepts, that prove that pretty much all the figures that were accused of being communist were. McCarthy's investigations were criticized for him lashing out, wild accusations, these things. That's sort of the nature of the investigation, because at the time he was being fed information from classified documentation. Good example, it couldn't be revealed at the time that the Venona intercepts or decrypts were existed, because that would have exposed sources and methods. So he really couldn't carry on in a way that would satisfy a court of law. So he had to carry out a sort of a political program. And indeed, loyalty oaths and these things, no one had a right to work for the U.S. government. In fact, any suspicion of loyalty had to be made in favor of the U.S. government. And that really, in the final analysis, really is appropriate. What we have to look at, what was going on at the time. When McCarthy burst onto the scene, the national scene, we want to overstate the fact, but apparently, throughout the 1930s and particularly through the war years, the federal government had been riddled with communist spies. Indeed, and from 1941 to 1944, FDR's vice president was Henry Wallace, who would have succeeded Roosevelt in April 1945 when he died if he had been pushed off the ticket in 1944. But Wallace himself, although was never tagged as a communist, his top advisors, Lawrence Dugin, Secretary of State, and Harry Dexter White, have subsequently been exposed as Stalinist henchmen. So basically, you had the America's national government in the 1940s within the heartbeat of being controlled by communist agents. It was just that bad. Now, what do we make of McCarthyism? As I said, the subsequent revelations or declassification documents have proven that most of McCarthy's charges at the time, being interpreted as being sloppy and undirected, and they have been vindicated. These all were spies. This was the early stages of the Cold War. And there really was a Soviet Union, and there was an extensive network of spies and fellow travelers in the United States working on behalf of the Soviet Union. At the time, the intellectual environment was the elite, the intelligentsia sort of had sympathy towards the communism itself, Marxism, and these things. They thought although the Soviet Union wasn't perfect and Stalin may have been excessive, his heart was in the right place. That was sort of their attitude. But then we get into the the Watt broader issue of McCarthyism in the context of the Cold War, and we've done a show in the past about the Cold War sort of being a controlled dialectic or staged event by the elite to bring in world government. And I guess we can get into that later in the conversation, but I think now it's time to let you get in with a few comments.
Okay. I think that McCarthy is very important to understand. I'm not sure that he's such a complex figure, and it's there is just a it's very difficult to get really a lot of hard data as to what he was attempting to expose. This really is to me the key, and I'm just going to quote the actual speech that kind of began his political thrust into the media, and then just explain my opinion on why this was so threatening and why he became a focus of the media to basically villainize. In his speech, which first of all, the speech he gave was against the Marshall, not just the Marshall Plan, but against Marshall himself. And there are a lot of accusations about Marshall's relationship with basically with Soviet Union representatives and also with people who were seen as communists in Europe, right? So Marshall was under some, there were just questions emerging about the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. And so in that context, McCarthy stepped forward in his speech talking about Marshall and the Marshall Plan. He said the following. He said, "How can we account for our present situation unless we believe that men high in this government are concerting to deliver us to disaster? This must be the product of a very great conspiracy, a conspiracy on a scale so immense as to dwarf any previous such venture in the history of man. Who constitutes the highest circle in this conspiracy? About that, we cannot be sure. We are convinced that Dean Atkinson, who steadfastly serves the interests of nation other than his own, who supported Alger Hiss in his hour of retribution, who contributed to his defense fund, must be high on the roster. The president, he is their captive." Okay, so that's he's directing that against Truman. Now, what is really interesting is that he doesn't actually focus on communism, but rather on a vast conspiracy. Because I'm sure as McCarthy looked at this situation, he could see interactions. Because, it's funny.
Yeah, because Ashes is not a communist.
Yeah, well, for example,
Yeah.
the Eastern intellectual kind of, Brahmins are all in communication with one another. But see, what I actually think kind of spurred McCarthy on was the Rees Committee. And
Yes, yeah.
you see, what happened was is they started looking at these giant foundations, and what they saw was not just tax dodging, but they started to see that there was this really strange relationship between these foundations and people inside Russia, inside the Soviet Union, and prior to that, within Germany. And so there was this question that had come up about, well, who are the elites? What is their, how does it actually operate? The Rees Committee was really, starting to get that exposed. And so then McCarthy comes forward, and he talks about the conspiracy. He actually uses the word over and over again. So he's not really addressing Marxism per se, but a conspiracy. And the other thing is, now I'll just mention that McCarthy, he was actually, if you look at really what he was bringing about an exposure of, it was the Council of Foreign Relations. This isn't, in fact, you just can't find any, current McCarthy scholars that talk about it. But the people that he named on the speech that I just mentioned, he mentioned Hiss and Atkinson, but he also mentioned a whole bunch of people by name. He would actually go out there and attack them. And he mentioned people like Frederick Vanderbilt Field, Loren Curry, Owen Lattimore, Philip Jessop, Charles Bohlen. Okay, and then, guys like Hiss and Atkinson. Well, in fact, these guys are all CFR members. Okay, so the conspiracy that McCarthy is becoming aware of is clearly in some way inside the Council of the Foreign Relations. Okay, what Hillary Clinton refers to as the mothership. So I think that this was what represented the greatest threat to the secret society, is that McCarthy, even though it was communism that had kind of, was sort of the beginning parts of what the investigation was looking at, it was really the international relationships. The secret society that McCarthy was starting to nose into. And so now what I think happens to him is that he is actually moved from that broader perspective into a more narrow focus. And he was always focused on communism. It was always sort of the first step. But you can see from the speech and from his accusation against CFR members, that he's close to, if not conscious of, but he's very close to an understanding of the beginning parts of the secret society. Seems to me it's just clear as a bell. And so he now gets focused by people around him, I think, more and more on just the communist aspect of it, that we have a communist problem inside our government. Well, this is, I mean, clearly this is a misdirection, because the whole process of history at this time is a misdirection, in my opinion. The Yalta Conference, was the gathering of the political representatives of the secret society to determine how best to exterminate Europeans. Right? This, to me, is really the subtext of the Yalta Conference. And one of the key things was the Iron Curtain, because that enabled Stalin and the Bolsheviks to liquidate, another, I mean, who knows? You've seen the estimates of 50 million, 30 million, just a huge number of Europeans could be liquidated without a lot of scrutiny. The Holodomor, the gulags, just the out-and-out starvation of even normal Russians, all this was able, they were able to pull off. And because the bond between the Soviet Union and the West that had existed during World War II had just immediately been snapped by the Cold War at the end of the war, they were able to create this partition. So that, in my opinion, the reason for it was to, just to create the ability to exterminate Europeans without a lot of scrutiny or awareness from the West. It basically, the Iron Curtain was set up so that Stalin would have, remember, he's just a Masonic cesspool. You look at all of the photographs and paintings of him with a hidden hand. He's, no matter how they try to dress this guy up, I think it's clear what he is. In any case, so McCarthy, when he enters into, the accusations of communists in the State Department, as you say, there was no doubt there were hundreds of them, but there were also, I think, representatives of the secret society. These are the groups that really had power, and so they just didn't like McCarthy's starting to begin investigations into, the Council of Foreign Relations relationship with the Politburo, for example, the Comintern, the Soviet Comintern. These kinds of relationships they didn't want to be investigated, and they certainly didn't want him to take it a step further, because now once you get there, then you can start to, actually move into questioning, well, what is the relationship between, Brown Brothers Harriman and the development of the Nazi Party? I mean, these are, many of the CFR guys are related to communicating with Brown Brothers Harriman group. And so if you start moving down this road, then you might actually end up with a citizenry that goes, wait a second, this whole historical narrative is nonsense. It's just being, woven as a fable so that we don't understand that we're being exterminated. See, that's my position. So anyway, so what happens with McCarthy is that I think the most important thing is Roy Cohn. Cone was given to him by Hoover. And Cone looks to me like an obvious operative. You know, if you look at his background, he is hired. He comes from a politically corrupt family. He's hired the day after law school by, you know, someone inside the Democratic kind of political operative world. And then he amazingly, even though he's only like 23, he's given this high-level status in the Rosenberg trial, right? And I think that what is being done there is they want to make sure that you don't get this idea that it's a Jewish kind of that there are no Jews that are like loyal Americans. You know, this was something that American Jews expressed a concern, and so Cohn is brought in and he's given this high level of publicity about being an anti-communist. And he's actually, if you actually read his his comments, he said that he's the one who really broke the case open, and he's the one who was able to get the death penalty for the Rosenbergs. That was his work, right? So he's this high-level operative that is defending Jews against this accusations. Again, I think that this is useful for the secret society. That's not an avenue of intellectual exploration that they want people to walk down. Hoover, of course, is obviously filthy. The fact that he's the one who brings Cohn to McCarthy is suspicious on its face. Hoover's one of the ones who made a conspiracy declaration. I don't know if you ever read it, but Hoover said that there is a great conspiracy, and it's so great that the public will never even believe it if they knew it exists.
Yeah.
It's sort of like open conspiracy, that statement of H.G. Wells, right? It's these kind of declarations that now in hindsight you don't make sense, but Hoover makes one of those at a certain enduring, I don't know where he made it, but I read it, and it's now in hindsight very clear, that Hoover understood. He was obviously he knew what was going on, and so he brings in Cohn. Cohn then focuses McCarthy solely on communism. Suddenly we don't really hear any more statements about the great conspiracy. We're looking for communists. And if you actually read the transcript of what had happened, and I think the whole thing was a setup. I can't prove this, of course, but what happens is McCarthy is in the hearings, and Cohn had made, he's what Cohn is what's called a member of the favor bank. I don't know if you ever heard the expression, but in the 50s and 60s, it was well known that politicians and high-level financial operatives would exchange favors, and typically they would be illegal, but this was just done as a matter of course. Now, Cohn had actually exchanged a so-called favor bank with Joseph Welch. I don't know if you've ever come across this data, but it's
That's
interesting.
interesting.
Yeah. So what happened was, Cohn had gone to Welch and had an agreement with him that basically that as long as they didn't go after that McCarthy didn't go after the communist background of of Welch's law associate Frederick Fisher, that Welch then wouldn't then bring up Cohn's the way that he escaped armed service. He actually had this very complicated way of getting out of the draft so he could stay a political operative. And inside, this is I'm not conspiracy theorying here. This is actually data that is, if someone noses around, you can actually dig it up. So Cohn had made this deal with Welch that Welch would basically ad hominem or him, Cohn, by for being a draft dodger, and in exchange, McCarthy wouldn't go after Frederick Fisher, who had been a member of what's called the National Lawyers Guild, which is basically a was known or at least accused of being a communist front. But anyway, McCarthy was very sarcastic and was goading, excuse me, Welch was being very sarcastic and was goading McCarthy, saying that he had no one, you couldn't name any names or nothing specific. And he was goading him this whole time. And then McCarthy snapped and actually went after Frederick Fisher. And so this was what actually led to Welch's is the violation of the favor bank exchange between him and Cohn, right? So it's just the whole thing is preposterous. But this is then and then just okay. So then you mentioned Edward R. Murrow's piece against McCarthy. Well, here you can really see that McCarthy is that there's an organized way to demonize him. They're going for term McCarthyism so that the path that McCarthy was walking down would never be walked again, or at least there would be this intimidation against it, right? That Edward R. Murrow, the Masonic cesspool, the thank heavens the chain smoked himself to death, but not soon enough. He did the hit piece on McCarthy, which was really interesting, very important, I think, for people to look at it and watch it, because he was able to use media, use the video images to make McCarthy look ugly, hate-filled, hysterical, right? As was pointed out by people who had seen it, because there was complaints against Murrow for having, created that piece. People pointed out that, wait a second, if you took the same raw footage and edited it another way, you could make McCarthy look noble, hero, and handsome,
Yes.
right? But anyway, so this is, as I see McCarthy, this is what happened to him.
Well, also, like, was it Drew Pearson also was enlisted in this, and a lot of other Jack Anderson, and so obviously the Mockingbird media and these things, and this again, this upsets the understanding of this conflict, because these are all CIA controlled journalists, and why are they attacking an anti-communist? Well, again, it's not that simple, is it? And I think Drew Pearson was also brought in to go after James Forrestal as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Who was a friend of McCarthy? Who both of them actually happened to die in Bethesda Naval Hospital. So,
Right, and that's the thing. McCarthy's death is always—I've always felt it was sort of like Patton's death. I mean, there was no specific reason for him to die. He had hepatitis, evidently, but people were dying of it. But he goes into a naval hospital and dies. I think that they had just, finished with their hit piece on him and just took him out. That would be my guess. But anyway, so. I just think that McCarthy is very hard to understand because the you have to really understand why he was so feared by the secret society and why they went to the extremes to work against him. You have to realize that it really wasn't communism that they were worried about having exposed. It was the next step, the fact the relationship between the Eastern establishment, gee, I wonder who these guys are, and the Politburo, right? That was really the relationship that they were afraid. But then, so then they brought in Roy Cohn, and then the other, another group that then kind of sealed the historical structure was William F. Buckley. Buckley then he came in and said, oh no, McCarthy was right. There was all these communists in the State Department.
This is the Cold War.
The Cold War, right. And so now, but this, of course, why we have to, be strong, and we need a strong national security agencies to, spy on Americans and develop all of this, slavery technology and things like this. So it was just this cover story.
It was a bureaucracy, atomic energy, centralized control for the duration of the conflict, as he stated, in
Yeah, it would
Conwheel.
be forever. It would just be permanent. So this is the thing, is that you have to look at McCarthy in that light, in my opinion, is that he they really to blow us up, so we need this powerful military and a big spy system. They really didn't want the relationships. And notice, I mean, I certainly am right in this, in that there were now, you can see in hindsight, there was just nothing but relationships between individuals in the CFR and the Politburo and then people in the Nazi Party. I mean, it was just this whole death machine of Europeans that was World War II and then the Cold War that followed. There was organizations everywhere, but it never became a news story. I mean, it's all just now, finally, there are people that are starting to, look at this as an overall system, right? Not just the dialectics that we're being told about.
It's interesting. I think it was McCarthy who was a friend of James Forrestal. I think he wrote, before meeting Jim Forrestal, "I thought we were losing to international communism because of incompetence and stupidity on the part of our planners. I mentioned that to Forrestal. I shall never remember his answer. He said, 'McCarthy, consistency has never been a mark of stupidity. If they were merely stupid, they would occasionally make a mistake in our favor.'" And
That's brilliant. Absolutely.
and
That's
then James and then I
right.
think the next day Forrestal jumped out the window. But anyway, 16th
Right.
floor of the Bethesda Naval Hospital. Of course, I think defenestration is a part of the assassination handbook of the CIA. But anyway, what we're getting at here, I think it was the late 40s, 46, 47, James Warburg, the scion of the banking family, the elite, banking family, Jewish banking family.
Establishment.
Yeah, he says, he said in the Senate, he said, we'll have world government, whether by consent or force. Either way, we'll have it. Now, you don't bring about world government really by force directly. You create circumstances that lead to it by controlling the dialectic, fomenting wars, and sort of creating various theaters of war and perception management, psychological warfare, social engineering, and these things. So what we're talking about is a very broad base, not just geopolitics, also domestic politics is involved in this, because obviously creating suburbia and breaking up ethnic neighborhoods was a part of this project of the American century, the Cold War agenda. But we'll talk about the Cold War dialectic. It's the West against, the barbaric enslaved East, the free world versus the communist world, and these things. And so the Cold War itself was essential, was a part of a process, a stage, if you will, of this move towards world government and these things. And world government is not going to be overt, it's going to be direct. It's going to be carried out through ideas of collective security, UN, these things, free trade, so-called free trade agreements, and whether it's the EU or it's the crisis in Korea, the police action in Korea. And as Dean Acheson himself said, that Korea was important in establishing the precedent not only of collective security, but also for the idea of the US president being able to declare war unilaterally. And I think it was the CFR in 1944 had written the problem of the Constitution, the obstacle it presented through their plan for world government, because Congress still needed to declare war. How do you get by this? You create a treaty in the UN which bypasses this stuff, and that's the UN Security Council. Of course, then you have Korea, and Dean Acheson said himself, Korea came along and saved us. What does it mean? Well, it's the crisis of Korea created justification for the Cold War. And the trick of Korea was that up and going into 1950, some of the critics of world government, those suspicious of these UN plans and the Eastern establishment, were sort of these anti-communist Midwestern Republican conservatives. And so all of a sudden you have this thing in Korea where the communists are invading South Korea. And so those anti-communists in the United States are forced to back Truman, because Truman's now being tough on communists. He was accused of being weak on communists going into the 1950s. So then you have that precedent established. But if you look at the history of the Korean conflict, is the only the reason why that war or police action started was solely because the US, I guess, during the Second World War had provided copious amounts of material and armaments to Stalin to attack the Japanese in the East, which he never did. So he transferred all those weapons to China and also to North Korea to enable the invasion. And then all of a sudden, everyone's caught unawares. And you have the conflict in Korea. And you have that setup. And George Marshall is very important in that, and not only allowing China to fall to Mao because they undermined Chiang Kai-shek, but even during the Korean War, Truman himself put the Seventh Fleet between Formosa, now Taiwan, and mainland China. He claimed it did this to provide security to Taiwan or Formosa. But the corollary to that plan was also that Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist forces couldn't invade the mainland. Well, you could interpret that as what he's controlling Mao's flank. And that frees Mao up to invade, to send Chinese troops pouring over the border in 1950 to attack MacArthur's soldiers. And you have that retreat, that famous retreat. And when the Chinese poured over, at the same time, Marshall, it doesn't allow Truman to bomb the bridges where the Chinese troops are pouring, using to pour into North Korea. So it's a complete setup. And
I just to interrupt, but man, that is so important. Yeah. Something people don't appreciate enough is that the communist revolution succeeded because of secret society intervention, and Marshall was the key guy in that process.
And Mao was a Yale, as they say.
Yes, Yale, right.
He had OSS support in the 30s and these things. So, you know, this goes back to that Chinese. This even takes us back to the Opium Wars, you know,
yes,
what's going on in China. Because China's being set up for something. We're seeing it now with China today. And then, of course, you have the example of the Vietnam War, where supposedly the war was waged by sort of these narrow-minded hawks. What it turns out, you know, people like Walter Rostow, Bundy. Walter Rostow's father was a Marxist member of the Communist Party. And he wasn't allowed in the State Department during the Eisenhower administration, but the Kennedy administration let him in, despite the fact warnings that he was suspected of having communist sympathies. William Bundy, another one, I think he was involved. William Bundy was backed Alger Hiss. Dean Acheson himself is his brother Donald Hiss. Was the lawyer for, you know, Donald Acheson was the lawyer.
Tim, really good analysis.
I mean, I'm like, it's like these guys are—they're not right wing hawks. They're but yeah. It doesn't make any sense. And the whole Vietnam War was thought up by the Wiseman. The Wiseman, I mean, Dean Acheson himself was out of all the lawyers in New York, by the way, when Stalin needed someone to represent the Russian Soviet intersection in New York, so they weren't recognized by the U.S. government yet. That was something the FDR did. I guess Stalin opened up the phone book, the New York phone book listing, and picked Dean Acheson to represent.
Shocking. Yeah, they didn't get like the Council of Foreign Relations key attorney. I mean, it's just shocking, isn't it?
I'm not saying Dean Acheson and Bundy were communists. They needed communism. They needed the Cold War dialectic.
Yeah, I just want to say, I just want to interject that. So what this shows is not, like you were saying, that Atkinson was a commie.
Yeah.
It shows that there is some overarching communicative principle that that these groups share.
Yeah.
And so when you see the relationship between Stalin and Atkinson, what you're seeing is an understanding of Stalin. Now you can understand the Gulag. Now you can understand the whole Molodor and the extermination of the European. It's all part of the same secret society structure that's going on all over the world.
Yeah, it's what the Rees Committee exposed, Norman Dodd and these things. And then subsequently, the subsequent research of Anthony Sutton about all the predicious aid that went to the Soviet Union. And also the important role that Western finance did in backing the Bolsheviks and these things. It all makes sense. And even Sutton himself, who pointed this, he was a scholar at the Hoover Institute, and he's exposing his breakthrough research about this stuff. And even at the time, he was relatively naive. He was like going to the Nixon administration saying, you know, why is Ford supplying material for the North Vietnamese that are used to kill American troops? Why are all these technology transfers and these things? And this history of London and New York bankers backing the Bolsheviks and these things. And, you know, he said because they wanted to take Russia out. And one way to take Russia out is you install Bolsheviks to screw the place up. But then he points all this all out and he gets fired from the Hoover Institute. It turns out the guy who runs the Hoover Institute is a member of the CFR. So there you go.
Yeah, so there you go. So, I mean, it just, you know, when you walk down these historical structures like McCarthyism, you always end up right back at the secret society and the fake dialectics and the genocide of the Europeans. Mm-hmm. I mean, all kind of, you know, there are twists and turns, and you look at McCarthy and you go, well, you know, there were communists, you know, there he had to expose them, and maybe this really was a focus of his work. But believe me, what is really going on here, what is really being structured is McCarthyism as an expression of unfounded allegations is basically just keeping people from walking down the path to Zionism, to the CFR, to the overarching secret society structure.
It's like conspiracy theory.
Yeah, it is like conspiracy theory, exactly. Yeah, and it just keeps, you can't really, in my opinion, honestly, you just can't walk through these things analytically without at least at the end of it having the strong suspicion that there is orchestration, and it's all going to end up with basically the state educating and producing children. You'll have this brave new world where the controllers will be, the CFR types at top, and down at the very bottom will be whichever's left of the autistic European. And so this is what I would, hope people would get out of McCarthy is not the, just an op. See, a lot of what it's sort of like people, are, they have this kind of a fixation on the Nazi Party, that there was something useful about it, that that it had principles that are applicable, and that there's a this hatred against it is being orchestrated. But they just need to take a few more steps analytically.
Well, nope. Any political party, no matter how demonized or ridiculous, it's going to have some legitimate gripes or claims in order to gain some political traction.
Exactly. You have to be able to have that as your foundation, or you won't get the turnout that you need for mob control. And so this is, it's even like with Marxism. Marxism, if you, the culture of critique is, such a good way of understanding, what's going on. Basically, Marxism used a kind of critique system against, capitalism to show that it needed to be overthrown, and that this would justify a dictatorship, which would also have to liquidate a lot of the population, right? It's just sophistry. Well, you look at all of these processes, and you end up with that same technique. And the creation of McCarthyism, this expression where, basically Europeans can't work through criticizing conspiracies inside of, our political class, and even, communists, right? It's just part of the mind control. McCarthyism is just a very active, powerful, it's like anti-Semitism, conspiracy theory. These are just terms that basically turn on and off the mind. And so that's really what McCarthyism is. It has been, the term has been created as one of the buzzwords which control the mind. And so if you were accused of being a McCarthyist or McCarthyism, you're just a bad person, right? You're just you're anti-Semitic, or you're a victim of conspiracy theory, or you don't like communism because you're greedy and you're a capitalist. Roy Cohn was a interesting character, and he came up with one kind of like amusing quote. Because he was asked about the Jewish aspect of communism, and so he said, look, he says, all Jews are not communists, but all communists are Jews. That's a quote from Roy Cohn. And so, he under, I think that quote is actually reflecting the data that Cohn was aware of, that if you looked in the Bolsheviks, right? I've been actually looking at this recently, and I'm just shocked by, that's just so hard to find any Gentiles inside the Soviet, in the Bolshevik Politburo. And in the governing apparatus, it pretty much was a Jewish operation. And so, when you have Roy Cohn as being so anti-communist, this to me just like it. I think that that's another, mind control.
Well, it's like all Jews aren't pornographers, but all pornographers are Jews.
Yeah.
It's a,
Except Larry Flynt.
Larry, well, mean by that, it's driven by, motivated by, it's sort of
Yeah,
the subversiveness of it all, tends to appeal to the Jewish spirit, revolutionary spirit. Yeah.
Yeah, that E. Michael Jones talks about
Yeah.
that. It's
It just
I don't know.
reverberates.
I think that there is a this kind of gets into the general concept of anti-Semitism, which I think is just completely irrational. The idea of attacking, an ethnicity or a race, you need to attack the secret society, right? And how it manipulates Jews. But when you then start to look at, like the religious Jews, you do have this issue of like, well, Deuteronomy,
Yeah.
and you go, well, are you in opposition to your scripture where it talks about the assassination or the genocide of these Gentile types because they're not religious? I mean, are you, like, how do you respond to that? Because the religion does have this problem in that it is genocidal against the Gentiles, and that, it has this chosen people. And when you go through Deuteronomy, it's not clear how many Gentiles are going to be left when, the chosen people actually manifest,
Yeah, then you have the, of course, the more, I guess, the relatively more modern codification of that in the Talmud, which is difficult to reconcile, with peaceful coexistence and,
Yeah, exactly. And then when you see like this overwhelming participation in the secret society of two groups, you have Jewish people like in the Bolsheviks, and then you have Freemasons. You have this bizarre fixation on the restoration of the temple, and are so often found in cooperation in weird ways with like Jewish banking people. I mean, like for example, the whole Israel project, which was this combination of the Rothschilds and but far more important were the proto-Zionists, who were all British Freemasons, Palmerston, all this whole group. And so, the explanation is that, they definitely want world government, and the population that really has to move out of the way is the European. I know it's a brutal statement, but my point is that well, how far down does that perspective go into Jewish people? And I don't think it goes very far, Tim. The problem is, it's completely embedded in the political class, in the European political class with the Masons, and I think with like the Likudnik type in like Jewish political world. And so what is a how does what is the citizen to do? You need to resist the fear of being charged with anti-Semitism.
Well, yeah, I mean, not every, I don't think not every Jew is Talmudic, but all the meaningful Jewish organizations, powerful organizations,
Right.
are Talmudic, and that's the problem.
Yeah. And that is the problem. And so when we walk down these paths, right, like McCarthyism, you in to be completely honest, you end up with this kind of analytic structure, right? And it's easy to imagine that charge getting hurled. Oh my God, there it is again. You're being anti-Semitic. But okay, feel free to hurl the charge, but hopefully, don't let the charge
Well,
stop thinking.
I mean,
Keep moving forward analytically, trying to understand the situation that we're faced with, because after all, we are being wiped out.
it's just historically incorrect, which isn't surprising, is that McCarthy was not hurling unfounded charges. He was
Right.
enforcing laws, or his investigation was based on laws that were passed by Democrats, New Deal Democrats. He was merely enforcing those laws and carrying on sort of the legacy of anti-communism that was sparked by the Truman administration. And it was Truman administration was stung because they were caught as being exposed by them, and so the initial investigation went against Truman and the Democrats. So there's some partisan element to this as well. But again, we're talking about the fact that these people like what Rothstein and Bundy had ties to communism, Marxism, CFR, and these things. They weren't war hawks. These were had actually they had, their pedigree was leftist and progressive, so to speak. So how do you reconcile that with the Cold War dialect, or at least the Cold War, what we think is going on with it's with capitalists versus communists, right wingers versus left wingers? Well, it doesn't make any sense because this is a staged event, and the dialectic itself is created to create the Cold War environment so they can have their Vietnam wars, they can run up the tab, run up the debt, make money off billions in military hardware, kill tens of millions of people, and you know, more or less set the stage up for the war on terror we got in the 21st century in these things. But this also happened domestically. I was reading an article, and in fact, I talked about this a while back with James Perloff about the function of Korea. So a lot of the information I got during Korea was from James Perloff, and he also wrote an article about Vietnam. He points out Ho Chi Minh was, again, like Mao, was an OSS asset, you know, at one time,
Sure.
you know. And in fact, in Vietnam, they went in there, and the whole strategy was there to nudge the French out. In fact, and destroy independent anti-communist organizations within Vietnam to make it reliant on the United States, so they can take out, you know, Bao Dai, the emperor who could have unified the country, so they can set up this divide with Ho Chi Minh in the south. They put in Diem, who's a Catholic, and who in a Buddhist nation doesn't make any sense. He's unpopular. South Vietnamese government is notoriously corrupt. It's a narco state, which is another function of the Vietnam War, was heroin and the drug trade. This factors into it because all these wars become very lucrative drug trade routes and these things. Think opium war again. That's a big part of it. Is the drug trade, not just the money, but also the effect that drugs have on society. We're seeing that today. But the domestic effect of the war itself, we've talked about this, how the trauma of the war itself was crucial to creating the cultural environment for the sexual revolution and the cultural revolution in the 1960s. Because you needed
Right.
the generational impact, you needed war to break the link between generations. Wars do this. You need the draft and these things and the trauma of the war. The media plays this part by televising it. And these things, but James Perloff writes about this what I'm talking about. He writes, since the same clique that got us into the war authored the restrictions preventing victory, he's talking about limited warfare in Vietnam. Really, the United States had the military means to win the war militarily. It was just drug out, you know, on purpose. Preventing Vietnam was clearly not a quagmire or blunder, but happened as planned, just like the revolution at home. In the Strawberry Statement, Notes of a College Revolutionary, James Koonin described the 1968 annual meeting of the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, which spearheaded the anti-war movement. At the convention, men from business international roundtables, the meetings sponsored by the Business International, tried to buy up a few radicals. These men are the world's leading industrialists, and they convened to decide how our lives are going to go. They are the left wing of the ruling class. They offered to finance our demonstrations in Chicago. We were offered ESSO, Rockefeller money. They wanted us to make a lot of radical commotion so they can look more in the center as they move to the left. That's his perception, I think. Jerry Kirk, a former member of the SDS and the Communist Party, testified before the House Senate Internal Securities panels that the radicals think they are fighting the forces of the super rich, like Rockefeller and Ford, and they don't realize that it's precisely such forces which are behind their own revolution, financing it and using it for their own purposes. When college students started burning American flags, they fulfilled a major Illuminist CFR objective, destroying patriotism, a prerequisite to world government. That's
Yeah,
insightful, I think.
that is very insightful. I mean, he should just keep going with that strand of analysis, and he's up in a really good place. You know, when you were talking about kind of it's like how bewildering, you know, the relationships are between individuals, you know, how hard it is for people to see the kind of the organization. I came up with the term lifetime actor. And the idea is to just help people analytically so that they can, you know, don't immediately buy into the media, you know, presentation of the individual, right? Try to always analyze in terms of like dynamics, you know, how the individual is fitting into the historical process, and always wonder if in fact the person is just completely fake, like, you know, Gloria Steinem or, you know, George Marshall or some of the really obvious individuals, you know, that are, you know, that just make representations of being this or that, but it's all there just for this overall cultural destruction or for, you know, setting up political control.
Any thoughts on sort of, you know, one of the charges of McCarthyism, of course, the accusations, the idea of blacklisting, cutting people off, just making them lose their jobs in Hollywood, you know, like Trumbo and these things, were supposed to worried about their fate. And really, if you think about it, if you're a shill for Stalin in the 30s or 40s, shouldn't there be some repercussions for that? I mean, obviously, there were if you were for Hitler, but the idea. You know, that you can be ostracized for having a political stance on things. Well, what occurred in the 50s was mild, really, because these people were eventually rehabilitated or brought back, and they never really suffered that much. They had declined in their income, so their lavish lifestyles had to be cut back a little bit. But look at today, where you have outfits like Amazon or PayPal, even credit card companies cutting people off from payment systems, getting their books. Amazon is engaged in a virtual massive book burning right now, where their hundreds of books have been taken off their list. And although Amazon itself, when it started, began itself as offering books for unlimited debate and access to these ideas and these things, now we have people being deplatformed for no particular vague reasons. So, I
Well,
mean,
because they have political positions that are dangerous to the oligarchs.
yeah.
That's why they're being taken away. It's just free speech is not going to exist in the new, IT world. It's just not there. That you can also see it, Tim.
Have they no decency? Have they no decency?
Yeah, no, they don't. You can see it now in like the search engines. They're all of the algorithms are being adjusted so that you can't get at any legitimate alt media positions very easily. You
No,
have
no.
to put in like a lot of words and things to get to them, which clearly were the more popular because they used to pop up number one
Yes.
several years ago. Now they're just back in the recesses of Google search engines. So they've created these ways to try to structure our minds, and it's the responsibility of us and people who listen to the show get it to try to resist this, right? By exposing it, first of all, have to
Yeah,
expose it.
Amazon pulls Kevin MacDonald's A Culture Critique, which is, I think, been out for 16 years after it being out there. But you can still get a Communist Manifesto on Amazon.
Well, I mean, Marx was one of their boys, so yeah, I mean, I didn't know the Culture of Critique had been pulled. It is actually pulled.
I think you can get Mein Kampf too, still. So,
You certainly can.
yes.
I mean, people are always, they're trying to get, I'm often attacked as because I'm anti-Nazi. It's part of the Atwell hysteria, where I'm also Jewish and this kind of like a complex, agent for, I mean, but the thing is, if they pull they have actually pulled the Culture of Critique.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I haven't checked myself,
Oh
but I was re
my
listening to a
goodness,
show
that
last night
would
talking
really be
about that. Yeah.
just shocking, and would really show that, the
I
public.
am. Are you familiar with Owen Benjamin, the comedian?
No.
Very funny comedian, but he's into like truth and conspiracy stuff. And he, I mean, he's been on a tear lately. But apparently, he was rather successful in Hollywood and these things in his own right. But he had a debate about Jewish power on one show, and he's been talking about the problem of Jewish power or Jewish influence in society, among other things, a lot of other things, the moon landing, things like that.
Yeah, a little
And
thing, yeah.
but this is how weird it is. His mother apparently was fired at her university position for the positions of her son, and that's the reason why she's like 77 years old, teaches children's literature at an East Coast university or college somewhere. Well, maybe it's part-time. This she is 77 years old, but I heard that she was the reason for her d dismissal were the public utterances and stances of her son.
Well, that's a very democratic position, isn't
I mean, I was
it?
like,
Right. And also, it's just the idea that they can't defeat the ideas, they have to attack the
yeah.
family. Let me tell you something. I will predict that the alt media will grow in popularity and in influence, intellectual influence, because we have to, because we are actually representing the truth. And
Yeah.
in fact, there's just too much data that supports the positions that we think are better analytic paths
Well,
than the ones we're being given. And so
yeah.
people are just going to naturally gravitate to us. But I'm telling you, they will come after us at some point. They will try to, that's why McCarthyism is actually kind of a good thing to get out there as something that's analyzed, because this is bound to be kind of the system that they're going to take against, for example, you and me. Eventually, if we become really popular, because they will have to, go scorched earth against us, as personalities, and also probably against, finance and family, because this is just how they play. And you've already seen this playbook, used on the other side of the pond in Germany
Yeah.
and so that's how they normally do it. So, if you suddenly see us publicized as bad people, just bear that in mind, please,
Yeah,
that
it's a no, I think
you
at this
can't
point,
be true if you're going to be a target.
yeah, if you're in the alt media, notoriety is a curse. You want
Yeah.
to you want hundreds of thousands of little voices out there, and that way it's harder to attack.
Exactly.
So
That's exactly right. And that's why, one of the things I always try to do is just encourage people to get out there and do blogging, do shows, do podcasts. I mean, take advantage of this opportunity while it's there. There is safety in numbers for one thing. It makes all of us safer when there's
yeah.
tens of thousands of people. But also, you just reach into little nooks and crannies, that shows like ours or other people just don't get to. We don't reach the. Unfortunately, we're not CBS. We don't have the kind of cable TV platform to get in all kinds of venues, all kinds of people's TV sets and computers. We only can go into the groups that are aware of us, that seek us out. But if you get thousands and thousands and thousands of more people, you'll actually end up with, these nooks and crannies will be illuminated, to use an expression, and then they can do the same thing. We can grow faster. We really have to grow the intellectual revolution, which is really what's going on now, as fast as possible. We have the power now with the internet to make progress, and we really have to take advantage of just as fast and hard as we can. I mean, I hope every single person that hears us and gets it is then inspired to say, okay, well, I'm gonna contribute. I'm gonna create a podcast. I have friends who I can create into an internet circle, and we're gonna start exchanging information.
Yeah, and of course, if when independent media personalities are taken down or deplatformed or accused, attacked, and defamed, and doxxed and rendered unemployed, you don't have an Edna Moreau there devoting a show to their on their behalf,
No, we're not going to. You're not going to see Wolf Blitzer. Found an interesting fact out about Wolf Blitzer, and I hope this is true. I'm going to repeat it. But he actually, before he was CNN, you know what he did?
Was he at APAC?
AIPAC. Yeah, he was an AIPAC kind of spokesperson, and kind of like, as far as I can tell, he was actually writing text for them. I mean, that's a good objective place to come from to get onto as a CNN commentator on the world, wouldn't you say?
Oh yeah, it's a great stepping stone. That's where you want to
Yeah.
go.
Yeah. So anyway, like, hopefully in the future, the stepping stone will be our show. This is what you have to come on if you want to go further into the media. We'll be the gatekeepers.
Okay, well, Joseph McCarthy, rest in peace.
Joseph McCarthy, McCarthyism, yeah.
I think we covered it.
I think we have to.
Okay, enjoy the
All
rest of
right.
your weekend.
Yep, you too.
Take
I'll talk
care.
to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.